again. Humorless man that he, who's with that sin, throw the first one, like you said. Let anyone else throw the second, as long as it connects with your head. One summer, then all of this is gone. One more summer, then no more swan.
Last gasp at Kalama.
Yes,
I have a lot of information. No, nice. I
have a page of notes on this song.
Dean, you're a madman.
Let He Who Is Without Sin tell us about Kalama.
I will.
Thank you.
So, Kalama was a town in present-day Algeria. And in 1408, despite it being forbidden by the...
408?
In 408. Pardon me. So in 408, despite it being forbidden by the church... they celebrated their traditional summer feast and then proceeded to have a big riot when people tried to stop them. And they destroyed churches and they stoned Christians that met them with opposition.
Yeah, so the goddess that was celebrated at Kalama was the goddess Callistus. So she was... also known as Tanit, who is, you know, okay, this is my issue with all of Greek mythology and
two
all
names.
Of Roman mythology. No. Oh my gosh, there's even more than two if you really get into it. But all female goddesses are the goddess of fertility.
Yeah.
But anyway, so she was the goddess of motherly, nurturing, and fertility, but she also was considered a great enemy of Rome. And she looked over the village of Carthage. So a lot of hate was around for this cult, especially because... everybody started making up facts that they were like into children.
Phoenician?
They were into child sacrifice. Mm. Which, fun fact, there's actually like zero evidence.
Yeah, they
said
that
about...
they
have not found any remains of child sacrifice.
They also said that about Olympias, that he was a child sacrificer.
Yeah,
which
that was
is
like
not
their
true.
Big
they also
Jews.
Said that about like yeah. Antifa, yeah. Which is crazy.
Yeah.
Jews, Antifa, Jupiter.
Uh-huh.
For sure. But one thing I found interesting that we can like tie through some of the other songs is... mm-hmm. She was also considered like the serpent lady.
Oh.
And the imagery of snakes come up a lot.
Again and again
in
this record.
In this whole record. And I thought that was interesting because snakes in Greek mythology are the messenger between like our world and the underworld.
Yeah.
Because they're seen to like live in cracks in the ground, which I thought was super fascinating.
Because
cool. I think they get into it on the next track.
Yeah, the next track is for the snakes.
Yeah. So... anyway, it was just super interesting because then they ended up losing anyway. I don't know if you got this far into it.
Yeah, this is the last gasp at Kalama.
Yeah.
Like they failed directly after this.
Bishop Aurelius ended up entering the temple, like into her temple, which was said to have been guarded by snakes, and just like sat on her throne and was like, this is Christian now. But then they kept fighting back against them. So the Christians ended up just like flattening the temple completely and like leaving.
Yeah. Like Frankie was saying earlier about how JD will start us out on a happy high note and then bring us down. Within the first three songs on this album, we go from Alon Raid, which is a like strategic military victory against the Christians, to Until Olympias Returns, where they're occupied and they're just waiting for their hero to come save them, to Last Gasp at Kalama, which is, okay, like, we know we're rooked. Like, there's no getting out of this. We're going to have one more big feast, one more summer, then no more swan. This is the last hurrah, and try to take down as many of these people as we can when we go out. The thing, like, yeah, this song... for me, it was very Daniel Johnston. I got big Daniel Johnston vibes from him.
Oh, yeah.
Another motif in Malgoat songs is understanding that, like, all of Transcendental Youth, their 2012 album, is about understanding that you are doomed and then going on anyway, which is exactly what these people do. So it's sort of like youthful, romantic, like summer rebellion. That's what this song is.
No, for sure.
Like of course, like after which your temple will be destroyed and your people will be, you know, completely subsumed by this like monoculture.
I feel like it made it sound almost like it was worth it though. If you're gonna get flattened anyways, you might as well take out a couple on your way down.
Exactly. And like the thing that I especially liked about this track, and it comes up again later in the album, is using Christian teachings against the Christians. Like you referenced before, let he who's without sin throw the first one, like you said. Let anyone else throw the second, as long as it connects with your head. So sort of like taunting the Christians, being like, oh, like you're prosecuting us, you're attacking us and our temples. But like, are you without sin? Like, how can you persecute us? Even though you're supposed to be like, you know,
oh, I love that feeling. Nice. Like, I love it so much. And it happens so often. Like, Heretic Pride is one of my favorite songs.
Oh,
it's
such
a banger. And it's just talking about how, like, if you're going to go out that way, like, you might as well go out as kicking and as screaming as humanly possible to make them as sorry for their choices as you as an individual can, because that's all you have left.
It's so good. This is a sequel to Heretic Pride, basically.
Oh, yeah. Except they get to, like,
he gets to throw a rock. Yeah. So the swan. Well, first, I'd also like to say they also talk about they're like they say last gasp at Kalama, but there's still like a little bit of hope because they do say they'll do what they're going to do anyway. But Carthage may rise again one day, which knowing that they were worshiping the patron god of Carthage is very, very cool. But also like Carthage was sort of the last like great threat to Rome. There was the Peloponnesian War. Is that what it was called?
It was when they salted the earth. Is that what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, that was the second Punic War.
Punic War.
Yeah. So there were like two major Punic Wars that Rome battled with Carthage. And Rome won both of those encounters. And after that, Carthage basically, like they salted the fields. Carthage was wiped off the map. It was never a big player in the ancient world again.
It's such a legacy, though, because like it was one of the few cities that they couldn't incorporate into like their... Because they're like, it's okay, maybe you can still like chicken and maybe hate snakes. And Carthage was like, no. Like, we're literally going to burn everything ourselves if you start trying to do it.
Exactly. So like, I don't know whether the singer wants Carthage to come back because they're done with Rome and they like just want to go back to, you know, pagans in a far off land that they can, you know, worship their god, or whether they want Carthage to come back to challenge Rome and to sort of bring things back to the way they were in the golden years of the Punic Wars. Back when Rome was like righteous and good, at least according to them.
Well, and that theme comes up as well in Their Gods Do Not Have Surgeons when they talk about the Temple of Isis in Memphis.
Yeah.
Because it's like making, like rebuilding a location for these cults to go.
Yeah. But so we talked about the swan earlier and how the swan is a symbol that no one would really understand just on its face. Do we want to try to crack it? Try to figure out what we think it is?
What you got for the swan, Dean?
I've got some things. I don't know if anyone else has some things.
Some swan research?
Well, I saw on Genius that it links to a Tennyson poem, but I didn't get into it.
It does link to a Tennyson poem, which is like fair enough, because like the swan in like ancient Greeks was like a symbol of beauty and nature, but also death, like the swan song. Was supposed to be the most beautiful song you ever heard, but it only happens after as the swan dies, because they're mute. Besides that, which is not true.
Also, Zeus turned into a swan to seduce somebody to create the egg that would birth Helen of Troy.
You're exactly right. Oh, bingo, bingo,
big
bingo.
Brain
so Leda and the swan is a classic Greek myth that's been like portrayed in paintings throughout history, but specifically. I'm interested in not the Tennyson poem, but the Yeats poem, Leda and the Swan.
Oh, yeah.
Which is because Yeats was obsessed with this idea of like cycles of 2,000 years and how like religions rise and fall. And he saw like when he was writing this poem in like the 1910s. He saw us at the end of the Christian era and the beginning of a new era that we didn't quite understand. While Leda and the Swan takes place 2,000 years before that, at the beginning of the Christian era, with Zeus taking the form of a swan to seduce Leda, who was the the Queen of Sparta. And that encounter led to, as you said, Helen of Troy, which started the Trojan War and sort of ended the mythological age and began the classical era, as we understand it, where this song takes place. So when he says no more swan, what is he talking about, you know, like the beauty, like this is like the death song of his people, of the pagans? Or is the swan Zeus, who is this, you know, like this all-powerful figure, this like masculine force imposing itself on humanity? Because like Zeus as the swan, it's unclear whether some people frame it as a seduction, but in the Yeats poem, it is very clearly a rape. Whether like, you know, these pagans, this persecuted group, are like sort of idolizing and worshiping like that sort of like masculine destructive tendency, whereas the Christians were pacifist and, you know, nice, supposedly. It's weird, like neither side is purely good, as like all of history is, I guess. But I don't know. What do you guys think? Where are you on this? Because I honestly don't know where I am.
I don't know. For me, like the swan is a symbol of like the crossroads between like humanity and the mythological age.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the ending of any kind of communications that the Hellenistic like cults would have in between like their gods and like themselves.
Right.
Past this point, where their temples and like their places of communication were being like burned and destroyed and like their practices prosecuted. But it also is a symbol of like violence and beauty at the same time. And I think the thing that I enjoy the most about this album, the way he portrays like the air quotes, like losers of this side of victory, is that he's not praising them as like peace loving people. He's still being like, no, like these are still like dangerous practices that contained violence. It wasn't all like beauty and singing and like bacchanalia. For me, a lot of the swan symbolism, just coming back to like the Tennyson poem, is like something that is beautiful, but because it is so beautiful, it also is dangerous because it clouds your mind's eye to what could happen to you when that thing comes closer. Because also swans are just scary as hell.
Oh yeah.
Because they're so big and so strong and very frightening. And so for me, that's what it was. It was like the communication between the cultists and their gods was being broken by not being able to have that communication anymore. Like the symbols are gone.
Right.
I think it's interesting though, like if we're talking about the swan as like a image of death as well, then why would the like second verse end with so much hope, right? Of like Carthage is gonna rise and, you know, you're gonna get what's coming to you kind of thing.
I don't think this is a hopeful song. I think this is a song where you're at the point where you've abandoned all hope, and as such you're not really sad or worried anymore. You're just like, ah, whatever. This is the last gasp. Like there is an understanding that like they are doomed and their cult is doomed. But even in that understanding, there's still like a whisper. Like at the very end, he can't help but put in, maybe Carthage will rise.
Yeah, you know? I almost feel like the chorus and the verses live independently. You know, like the verses are very like the pagans at that moment of like, this is what we're going to do. We're being hopeful, maybe. Whereas the courses are kind of like interjecting in that of like, but
yeah,
maybe not.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. Should we move to the snakes now?
Yeah. Yes, please. More snakes.
I want to talk
more
about
snakes.
All your brambles, all your creeping vines, all of the trash that people leave behind. All your fine columns poking up through the pond scum. We will have uses for these things when we come. Cracks in the marble you hauled in from the quarry. These will be seen by all in all their glory. Long hidden shadows of the places they came from. We will bring memories of these things when we come. All your abandoned things,
Once fine vestments, statues with wings. They have their uses, everyone. Let me slither across them in the sun. Pale imitations that you brought back from afar. We will show them to you as they are. Wind through the ruins, high and lonesome. We will have uses for these things when we come.
For the Snakes is the fourth track on this record. And as we were saying before, it's got a lot of serpent imagery, which I read just as like explicitly not Christian, because like the serpent, you know, is the devil in Christian mythology. So just being just basically saying to the Christians, you know, like you're having your fun right now, but eventually your enemy will rise and it won't even be us. Like the pagans, like, sure, like maybe you wipe us out. Maybe like we lose our history to the ages, whatever. But one day this empire will fall and all that will remain are all that slither and crawl, which I didn't mean to make rhyme.
Bars, my guy.
Thank you, my dude. but yeah, I sort of like that. Like, it's almost sort of like an ecological statement is sort of how I read it. Ooh. Like there, in the battle of ideologies and these like religious battles that are taking place, at the end, nature is all that will prevail and take over. And I just have one more thing to say, is that this is the second song in the Mountain Goats oeuvre, which is specifically about snakes rising and taking over the world. Very cool. The first one is called Super Genesis. It is great.
Aren't snakes also a very pro-pagan image?
It's because they're like symbolic of rebirth and like regrowth. Because
and stuff.
I thought there was tons of symbolism in like the pagan mythos.
That's why you get like that symbolism, like what's it called? Steph probably knows the medical band where it's the two snakes.
Oh, the caduceus rod. Yeah. Is it caduceus?
No, it's something else. I can't remember.
I like the word caduceus because it sounds like skadoosh. The skadooshes rod.
The skadoosh.
Yeah. The staff of Hermes.
Staff of Hermes.
There's also like the imagery of the snake eating its own tail.
Or the rod of
which they reference in this record. In I think it's Hopeful Assassins of Zeno. When will the serpent devour itself longer than we think?
So I think snake imagery is not only like Christian fear, but also it's very much pro like pagan and other religions, because a lot of religions use the snake as like a very like pro wisdom symbol and like rebirth and like the shedding of the skin and stuff like
right.
that. I feel like for a lot of religions it is a very pro symbol, whereas in Christianity it's historically seen as like a negative symbol,
an incarnation of Satan.
Like you know, even especially with the story of like Adam and Eve and stuff like that, and the way we think about that today, snakes, you know, tend to be the slithering, conniving ones rather than the actual like purveyors of truth, where a lot of religions see it, a lot of other religions see it. So I think not only, like I said, it's not only like a anti-Christian sentiment, but it's also just like a pro-pagan sentiment.
Yeah, and like this song in particular, all of the things that the people, the Christians, have built are seen as cheap imitations. There's cracks in the marble. It's all like it's all fake. They're all like not real and true. But what is real and true are the snakes that will come and take over.
Right.
So sort of turning that like snake as the trickster, as the liar on its head.
Yeah. And same with like natural imagery as a whole in a lot of like pagan religions, or like, you know, pre-Christian religions even, tended to be like nature was the thing that you worshipped, right? And like things growing was what you wanted. And I can imagine that like rather than building a temple just as like a symbol, you know, you would see things that were naturally formed as a temple, rather than like you would build something to signify your belief system, right?
Right, right.
So I think that definitely goes hand in hand. It's like, it's a weird like eco-crit thing, but also definitely like...
That is exactly, I read this song specifically in like an ecological context.
Yeah,
I think you're exactly right.
Yeah, but also it definitely ties into like as far as I'm aware, very early pagan beliefs.
I think it's even like earlier pagan beliefs, because I think they're willing to say like at this point in the failure of their ability to punch back against the Christians that they don't even care if they come back.
Yeah, yeah.
It's because just that what was there before either like the Hellenistic cults or Christianity like will come back again.
Right.
And everything will fall. It's not just the statues of Christ, but it's also like the statues,
yeah, the
of
statues
like the
with
God.
Wings, yeah.
Yeah.
Literally, yeah, like everything. Even themselves are going to, it's going to end eventually.
Exactly, like in this ideological war, both sides lose and then nature reclaims it.
Yeah, yeah, but, which is like a huge win for the pagans.
Yeah.
They're like, even if we're gone, if nature wins in the
end. As long as you lose.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
But speaking of pagans living in nature, the next track here is The Wooded Hills Along the Black Sea.
Cause no trouble, keep to our own kind, known to exist, hard to find, neck deep in our passions, serve who we serve, enshrouded in moonlight, bucking the curve, under the radar, just out of reach, among the thick woods, a mile from the beach.
I love The Wooded Hills Along the Black Sea. I think it's one of their best Casio keyboard songs.
The
it's
burden
just, like,
of
it's so
exile.
Much more complex than the earlier stuff
it's
that he used
to
do. Which, like, even like songs on like perfect,
sometimes
beautiful records, like All Hail West Texas, Blues in Dallas,
there's
not a great tune. It's not very good.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, hearing this progression just axe. It warms my heart.
So it's good because they you've noticed that. His work has gotten better.
It's markedly better, yeah.
Okay. Okay, yeah, I can imagine that. I was thinking, when I was listening to this track, the thing I liked is that it wasn't good. Genuinely.
Yeah.
I was like, this is what I like.
It's the most basic piano melody ever.
I was like, this.
And it repeats itself over
I was like,
and over
don't
again.
Listen to Blues in Dallas.
I was like, I
or
love.
Or any other pop music, but yeah.
I was like, I love this because it's not doing anything else, which a lot of the album is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And even when it is doing something else, like pulling in the Casio keyboard, putting a drum track behind it, I was like, this is so straightforward, not trying to pull the wool over your eyes whatsoever. It's literally just, here it is.
You know, think this song is more honest than the other ones? Like, less smoke and mirrors? Because I think they're all very... Really? Because I find the whole album as a whole... I find the album as a whole very, like, to the point, like, I've thought of the song, I've written it down, I'm turning my boombox sideways, and then I'm recording.
Right. Yeah, no, this track, for some reason, it hits me differently because it reminds me of how you would write a song before it's actually produced. Like the other tracks, a lot of people can pull off the I'm a dude with a guitar and I'm singing.
Mm-hmm.
And like, but that's like the full production of a tune, right?
Right.
This sounds like the pre-stages of a song. This sounds like a song that isn't even written yet.
Yeah.
Like this sounds like someone trying to work something out and being like, does this work? Does this sound good? And then just it's on the demo now. You know what I mean? Like it sounds like someone who had the idea and played it and was like, okay, yeah, like this in itself is all right.
Yeah, I'm very excited for like when we can go to concerts again and see touring bands.
Oh God, him doing this.
with the full band, this song with the full band.
That's
oh
what I mean.
God.
That's what I mean. So I kind of like God. This because it's one of those things where in your head, like, I can feel where the rest of the music is.
Yeah. Right.
I also personally, this song stood out the most, like, musically wise, because I think the lo-fi recording with the keyboard sounds much better than it does with guitar chords. Because a lot of the, like, heavy guitar chord music just kind of blurred together.
Yeah.
So, like, all you heard was just, like, this wall of sound of, like, coming at you. And you're just like, okay. Whereas this, you're like, oh, I can follow a little bit of a melody.
Yeah, yeah. Like, this sounds like, you know, someone had a few drinks. It's 4 a.m. at their friend's house and they found the keyboard from the closet.
And turned on the drum machine.
Yeah, and made
a song that sounds like an old scary computer game.
And that's what you do.
Yeah.
Like, that's what you do when you're kind of stuck creatively. Like, you mess around. And I'm not saying that it wasn't deliberate, but what I am saying is, like, this to me sounds less like the aesthetic side of things. And it's more like, this is the basic rudimentary, we're not even filled out whatsoever. Like, this is not what you would necessarily put on an album unless you really wanted someone to think that, you know, I'm working with very little right now. Like, you wouldn't throw this on the album unless you wanted people to realize how little you're working with when it comes to, like, what you can record with and what you can write with, right?
Right.
Like, it sounds like he's trying something different and he recorded it and now it just happens to be on the album for us to listen to rather than him deliberately you know, writing it in this fashion. Like, I feel like if he could have, this song would have been much bigger than what has showed up on the album. And I kind of like that. It's kind of humbling in a sense. And it's a lot of, like, the music makes me feel like it's like you're working with yourself, right?
Yeah.
Which a lot of the album does give across as well. But then we've also heard tons of music where the be-all, end-all is a guy with a guitar.
I don't know about you, maybe. It felt a lot like, is it Wild Sage? Like the walking song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where not musically, but like emotionally,
like,
where it's like you're obviously planning on killing yourself or you're going to be dying soon and you're noticing like small things.
Yeah. In Corolla, I think you're thinking of.
Hey, I'm totally in the full heat of this one, so I haven't bothered to tune, so I'm not at 440 here. I don't know what to tell you. I'm in G, anyway. Everybody's taking notes. January 31st, 438. 2, 3, and...
When the hunger turns in on itself and begins to devour its host, who do you turn to for help? The ones that brought me, I dance with the ones that brought me here. When the word comes down the wire that they're looking to make an example of you, skin and bones around the campfire beneath the stars,
so the reason
no good and in view. I dance with the ones that brought me. I dance with the ones that brought me.
I've noticed that juxtaposition in conjunction with January 31st, 438 is because of the fact that they both deal with the repercussions and the punishments of being pagan. So up until this point, we've been really talking about like the persecution of the pagans, but not actually the fact that like this was an illegal practice, so if you were caught participating in anything that they would normally do, you, for a while, you were sentenced to death. So then when we get to the wooden hills along the Black Sea, that's when the law changed in 421 so that rather than being sentenced to death, they were just exiled. And then past that, on January 31st, 438, that is a nod to the... who wrote it? That's a nod to the date that
Codex Theodosius.
Yeah, the Codex Theodosius was published, and it actually made it so that rather than being exiled, you were sent to death again. So it's this really interesting comparison between like
this one moment of like maybe hope that like, well, we're exiled, but like at least you can still practice, you can do what you want, but you're just like exiled, which sucks, but you're not dead.
Right.
You
and
know,
when you compare the two songs sonically, it's interesting because The Wooded Hills is very like somber and melancholy and slower, while January 31st brings back the guitar, the like peppy, like fast strummy guitar.
Yeah.
And he's talking about dancing, even though it's a song about how him and his people are going to be executed for what they're doing.
Well, it's interesting, too, because there's nothing about that song that's happy, like thematically wise, because they're talking about like the famine. They're talking about death, you know, and they're still dancing, whereas you're right in like the song before, it's somber. And like lyrically wise, I don't think there's really anything that like sticks out to me that's very happy.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, again, another typical Mountain Goats trope is the like song detailing like tragedy and ruination that's like so up tempo, and he's just, it sounds like he's singing about candy bars. It's great.
Yeah. I also really like the intro bit. So it was 438 the year that this declaration was written.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So like the intro bit on that song is where he talks about he's like, sorry guys, I'm not in tune or whatever, this isn't in 440, sorry about that. And then the song starts. So like 440 is the hertz in which the tonal A, like the note A that you tend to tune to. Mm-hmm. You can also tune to other things. A lot of like modern orchestras tune their instruments to different hertz in order to get like a different sound.
Right.
But like 440A is like very standard tuning style. So like him being like, oh yeah, this isn't in 440A. And then the song's called 438. And it's I don't know, it's very tongue in cheek. And also I'm pretty sure it's actually down tuned, just like that slight amount where your ears can't actually really parse it out, but it knows that something is different.
That's so clever.
So I loved that. He's like, oh, sorry guys, this isn't super in tune. And it's because like he's talking about the year 438, not tuned at 440, probably actually tuned at 438. Again, you can't really tell, but it's definitely something that he did.
But like even like being in the full heat of the moment is something that like AJD is claiming here. But also many of the characters within like this album, but like this song specifically, are people who are sort of like swept up in the zeal and the you know, their devotion to their god. They're dancing with the ones what brought them.
So I think on one hand, like, you know, you could take it as him being very earnest about the like recording style. On the other hand, I think it's a callback to how he used to record, and also the comparison of how he used to record things and the people that are in this moment that he's describing.
Mm-hmm.
It's really like, it's beautifully ironic, like the comparison that he's making between the tenets of Christ and like the way he brings those up a lot and then uses them against the Roman soldiers when he's talking about who do you want at your side at the end of things, and like talking about starving to death and how like a lot of the tenets and the commandments are having to do with like love and acceptance and like all of that type of stuff. And I think he's drawing more on like the more current understanding of those commandments than what they would have been doing like at that point in time. But I think a lot of this song specifically is the irony of like prosecuting these people to death and like to starvation and isolation outside of their communities. And he's like talks specifically about like crushed like a seashell on the seaside warrior's foot, like just completely ousting these people from the community entirely, where he's talking about he who without sin like throw the first stone, or how you measured so shall you be measured, and all of these different catchisms. And it really like becomes very bitter for these two songs especially.
No, I thought it was interesting too. I like the line, let me go down dancing, let me be the last one left, especially because in comparison to the what was it, Until Olympias Returns, where they're saying, oh well, we'll do what you guys need us to do because we're just waiting patiently for us to have our moment.
This is just a brief improvisation in the dance is what he says.
But now they're like, well, let me go down dancing, because they've realized that they're really out of hope and they have to just, you know, do what they're going to do, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, most of the mystery cult idea, especially when you look towards like Dionysus and what you see in like the Bacchae and stuff, is all this like dancing imagery. And it's really what sets apart, you know, the mystery cults from, you know, like the traditional gods that they would worship, or later Christianity, right? And, you know, like, dancing was pretty much outlawed in Christianity until like 20 years ago.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
Like, there was certain
Footloose. After Footloose came out. Yeah.
Like, after Kevin Bacon. Was it Kevin Bacon?
It was Kevin Bacon. I was looking for the name.
The world against the people that said dancing was bad. But that, like, we laugh at that, but that's like exactly it. It's this idea that like dancing makes you hypersexualized and is going to make you sin, right? And like, it's going to make you drink more and stuff.
Yeah.
And it comes from this, right?
I had no idea. Like, I just thought like Dance with the Ones That Brought Me was like a cute way to say like, oh, I'm going to worship my God. I just thought that was like, oh.
No,
like,
but they did it for everything, though. It wasn't just like processions that were like celebratory. It was also part of mourning where they were like dancing, and like they would do like the screaming and like the hair tearing and like their beating on their chest and playing other instruments.
There'd be instances where you dance until you faint, right? Like, you would just dance until you essentially collapse in order to show that like you've put that much effort into the dancing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also
that was like
part
a main
of
part
of
things.
That
too.
Yeah. So it's that idea of like music plus movement puts you into an altered state of consciousness where you're more susceptible to having these kind of religious experiences.
Yeah.
Which there is merit to. Like, they've done really cool scientific studies on it. So, you know, the Christians weren't all wrong.
Huh.
It's like, hey, how are we going to keep these people from properly celebrating their religion and feeling like they have certain religious experiences? And it was
monkey brain, like the thump thump.
Yeah, exactly. If I beat my chest hard enough.
If I beat them hard enough.
Yeah.
But it's very true, right? Like, and you see it in religions all over the world. And that's why dance tends to be the main thing that gets cracked down on, not only because it's a very public display of like your devotion to whatever religion it may be, but also it has a lot of like strong spiritual and emotional baggage to it.
Yeah, and I think even more so, it brings about community. So like you never really see people dancing on their own solely.
Right.
Most of the time, if someone's dancing, they're with other people, or they're at least dancing for other people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So there's a certain part of like embodied community ritual that is very solidifying in how religion is kind of maintained from this community standpoint. So like, you stop the dancing, you stop the community.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's a good way to like nip it in the bud.
They came like beasts who tasted blood, first a few and then the flood, coursing over hill and dale, wet paw prints on their bloody trail. Return the peace you took from me, give me back my community, show us the goodwill you were shown, or leave us alone. The temple of Isis at Memphis, yeah, restore the temple of Isis at Memphis. Like a worm inside them, no sacred place could be denied them. They who talk all day of beauty call all the plain things dirty, melted holes in celluloid. Give me back what you've destroyed, you who come demanding proof. that your God rebuilt this roof and restored.
Dean,
the temple.
I want to hear something about this track, Their Gods Do Not Resurgence. I know you have some feelings about it.
Yeah, it has a fantastic title. Honestly, this is not one of my favorite tracks on this list.
Oh, really?
It's just like a little too slow and sad for me. I really like the lyric, "Give me back my community." I think, like, especially considering how this record was written in quarantine, that rings super, super true.
Yeah.
Not being able to go to concerts and to, like, be with, like, the music community. The concerts that he was supposed to attend.
Yeah. Think about the second verse, because that was the one that made the song good for me. I agreed. Like, a lot of it was really somber, and I was already sad, so I was like, I don't need a lot more. But I really liked the lines, "Their hunger was like a worm inside them, no sacred place could be denied them." When they talk of beauty, or they talk all day of beauty, calling plain things dirty.
Yeah. Yeah, I, like, again, sort of, like, turning, like, the Christian teachings against the Christians who were persecuted and now are persecuting the pagans.
I don't know if I can't really necessarily think of a specific passage in the Bible, but I know that, like, the kind of theme of having a hunger for God is like talked about a lot in Christian communities. Their hunger, like a worm inside them, no sacred place could be denied them. So, like, turning every single spot into this place where they wanted to find God.
Yeah.
And then displacing other people's gods by doing this.
There's actually a really interesting, like, time skip in this verse, like in this song specifically, that you don't get a lot in the other places in the album. Because I know when we listen to, like, a lot of other Mountain Goat stuff, there's a lot of, like, time changes between the characters and the song, and then the autobiographical, like, kind of skipping in between, like, 30 or 40 years. But this one, it goes like, "Melted holes in celluloid, give me back what you've destroyed."
Yes.
Where I'm like, that's another person talking. Like, that's a different plane of existence that we're on for those two lines.
Yeah. And, like, it's interesting. Like, I haven't mentioned it before, but, like, throughout this record, there are certain, like, moments where he lets the mask slip a little bit. And he it's almost like he's playing characters, he's performing, but there's certain lines, like that one, "Melted holes in celluloid," that the speaker, like the, you know, devotee of ISIS, would not know about at all. So it's almost like the album is, like, zooming out, and, like, we're starting, like, from this very insular perspective from Alon Raid to, like, a specific event that happened, and then slowly zooming out to see, like, the wider scope of this story and these people, and zooming out more to see John looking at these people and his interpretations and feelings around it.
I think that's a lot why I didn't need, like, the book so much to make it relatable. It was, like, these, I don't want to call them slips, but, like, the gaps in the personification of the characters.
Yeah.
Where it lets you, like, breathe a little bit and, like, understand things from a different perspective, as opposed to the victimization perspective that he's using for most of the songs.
Right. And then, like, by the very end at Exegetic Chains, it's strictly him singing. It's no other character.
Yeah. I think it's kind of like the way you said it, from the micro level to the macro level. Like, you kind of go on a trip from... And it ends up feeling like what you're reading and what you're listening to is someone's thoughts on a book that they're invested in, right? That has historical importance. And then how they're trying to piece it together with, like, their day life, but also while still just being very passionate and invested in reading this book, which is what I think happened.
We're basically doing an album report on a book report that JD turned in, but he recorded it on Casio.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're recording it on...
on whatever this is.
Yeah.
Can we get an upside down boombox, please, Dean?
Yeah, okay, I'll invest in one for the stage.
But so we can record it together.
Yeah. I think even, like, lines like that, where you kind of take another step back, and it sounds more like you're learning about someone... who's learning about something for the first time.
I also think, going back to your idea of zooming out, I really liked that, because I do really feel like this album does that. And I think that's why I like how we've kind of gone through it song by song, which we don't normally do. We normally just kind of jump around wherever the conversation takes us. But I think as well, you know, like, this is the first time we've even discussed one of the Egyptian gods, which is very interesting. And ISIS had the most widespread following. So they had people following her from England all the way to Egypt.
Wow.
Yeah, so...
Big deal.
Because it spread across the whole Roman Empire.
Look closely at the shadows on the ground beneath the trees. The labors of Hercules. Wild grasses on the hills, rippling in the wind. Sibylle Unchained. The songs you sing at Christmas time, the stories that you tell. Well, I knew them well. Yes, I knew them well. Say your prayers to whomever you call out to in the night. Keep the chains tight. Make it through this year. If it kills you outright. The coins they toss at dancers whirling in the city square. Music on the air. The places where we met to share our secrets.
So,
now
folks,
and then.
Do we want to end on the most interesting track? Your exegetic chains. Steph, what is an exegetic chain?
We will see them again.
Well, so exegesis is the practice
change
of
will come.
A critical reading of a book, but most specifically it's used as a reading of scripture.
Right.
Inside. Yeah. I don't understand the chain part of it.
It's just like
so
a fancy word for
pain. Exegetic chains is a phrase that Shuvin uses towards the end of the book. Referring to his own interpretation of what he's talking about. He says something like, let us not get wrapped up or ensnared in my exegetic chains. Which, again, like sort of going back to like the pseudo-intellectual nature of this band, is something that John would be tickled by. Because he, like, just the idea, like, that's a funny phrase and like a very academic phrase. And then sort of taking that and deconstructing it and being like, not like, oh, look at these fancy words that I know and I'm using, but sort of turning them into art and turning them into something like approachable and human. And like using like this jargon that is sort of in many ways barred from normal conversation and like only academics can use this very precise language and bringing it to his listeners and being like, let's play with these words. Like they're not just for academics.
Yeah,
the very first lyrics are, look closely at the shadows on the ground beneath the trees, the labors of Hercules. So for me, that's like, again, exegetic chains. We've zoomed out directly to John's perspective. And he's looking at the shadows of the trees now. And in it, he sees the mythology and like the heroes and the monsters, just like within like normal nature in everyday life, like these myths still exist and inform
like he's,
him today.
He's doing the level of abstraction that I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Where it's like you're applying these stories to the current modern day and what you see in front of you, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
It is a part of who he is in the present day.
Right.
But,
right.
Okay. So do you know the mythology of trees and the underworld?
Ooh, what did trees
there's
do?
There's a pomegranate down there, right? That's all I
yeah,
know.
Yeah,
what?
There's the pomegranate
only six
story,
seeds.
But
Really?
Yeah.
The mythology of the tree in ancient Greece, especially more specifically cypress trees, but I think some of it can maybe be applied to here as well. The cypress tree was thought to be the first thing that you would see when you entered the underworld. So like that would be the signifying of you're dead.
Okay.
Because the idea was that a cypress tree, once it's cut down, it doesn't regrow at all. So they kind of saw this theme. And so that'd be the signifying thing of like, okay, you've entered the underworld.
Okay.
And then there was usually instructions on like which side of the tree you have to go to. And if you didn't follow these instructions carefully, you were doomed to purgatory basically for the rest of
your existence. So in a way, like we've reached the end of the album. So now it's sort of almost like, I don't know if it's the death of like the narrator or the pagans in general, but almost like, we've come to the end of this album. We're like, this is like the final choices, the final thoughts that we're making before we cross over into the underworld of listening to Not the Mountain Goats anymore, which is in a way like death.
Well, and I think too, you can also look at the idea of like, you know, the labors of Hercules, right? Like he had to go through these things to become a god, right? Mm-hmm. But if he's also laying on the ground beneath the trees, he too is dead.
Right.
You know, these gods have also died.
Yeah. Like, like Hercules, I guess, like is at the foot of the tree, but also in the wild grasses on the hills, he sees Cybele unchained. So Cybele was another goddess of like motherhood and fertility.
Yeah. The same as all other goddesses.
Exactly. Yeah. but yeah, like, so that seems a little more triumphant to me. Like she is no longer bound. And again, like tying the pagans and their beliefs specifically to nature, I find interesting.
I don't know. I don't know about like some of the underworld images and like the death of the gods is coming through. For me, it was more like a Midsommar and like the translation away from like traditional motifs to like a very real and like living and breathing example of like your gods in nature. And so it wasn't the fact that the tree represents the underworld, it's the fact that the trees are still alive, and like the lines like we will never run out of trees, or like we're hiding in the trees, is such an important motif throughout the entire album. And I think the implications of like the trees and like the wild grass and like the parts of the Hellenistic religions that you can't get rid of, or like the pagan symbols of nature as like wealth and regrowth, is not destroyable by the Christian ethos, even if they try to change the meaning. And for me, it was not that these symbols are dead, it's that you have to now look at them in a different way.
Yeah.
And that it's, they've experienced their own cycle of rebirth, which is different and requires a different way of looking at it. So like the old ways of looking at them through like the lenses of like the systematic dancing and the temples and the mystery cults is gone and is dead now. But you have to look at like the dancing in the grass and like the swaying and breathing of the trees as something that is equally as important as it was when it was the temple figure.
Yeah.
And so for me, like that was the change. And it wasn't like the death of the idol. It was instead like the rebirth of the idol through an individual lens that you can pan out or zoom in on as much as you need to.
Right. Like that's exactly it. It's not that like the pagan tradition is dead, is that it's hidden.
Yeah,
And like even
well, they
like
say
in
the Christmas time,
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah,
the songs you sing at Christmas time, the stories that you tell, I knew them well.
Mm-hmm.
Coins they toss at dancers whirling in the city square. Mm-hmm. Again, that dancing motif, right? Of like there's still people dancing.
Yeah, exactly. Like these traditions live, but like they are an undercurrent. They are the hidden rhythms on the air.
I was gonna say it's like. And there's got to be an actual word for it, but like transitional worship, where it's like it evolves over time and you don't realize that you're doing it, but mm-hmm. you are definitely still doing it and like influenced by those original.
I think it's like the malicious compliance coming to an end, where you've maliciously complied so hard that the other side can't understand that you're winning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like they don't know. Like they think it's gone, but you're like, well, we know what you're doing. But that's okay. We just won't point it out to you yet. Like we'll hold on to that one. We'll wait until it's so solidified in your traditions that you think that you are the ones who came up with this stuff. And then eventually, like maybe we'll tell you.
Yeah, it's a real like push me pull you, like the two-headed llama, where it's like are you like, is it because it's been so indoctrinated like into Christian practices that now this is Christian and like by practicing these things like they receive the upper hand, or is it because it's secretly pagan that the pagans receive the upper hand? And you like from either side, right, you could be like some kind of little hope on that use of those motifs now. And
right just how like I said, like the transient nature of those practices and like what they've evolved into, or you know, a lot of people would say they devolved, but like more so it adapted into these different practices that we use on day to day in our day to day life. And it's like, who really has the upper hand here?
Yeah. And I think you can see that too in the line where it's headed somewhere better if I have to crawl there on all fours. Because I'm sure Dean can go more into this, because apparently this is a nod to a past, I think, song.
Oh yeah, like headed somewhere better if I have to crawl there on all fours. Genius here says that it's Hast Thou Considered the Tetrapod reference, which again, another fantastic title.
Very good.
Very, very good. But yet, like, JD, like, has always, again, he's constantly, like, brings up images of snakes, of things that have to crawl along on their bellies or crawl on all fours, of, like, sort of, like, misanthropic, like, lesser beings that he really likes. Like, in Damn These Vampires, he says someday he'll learn to walk upright. The thing that I'm really interested in here is the chorus and the phrase, keep the chains tight, because the song is called Exegetic Chains. So when he says keep the chains tight, for me, that's sort of keep your interpretations, keep your like religious leanings, your pagan beliefs to yourself. Keep that tight. Keep that close. And then he says, make it through this year if it kills you outright, which is a specific reference to their most popular song, probably This Year.
Which also has a line in it that says, there will be feasting and dancing in Jerusalem next year, which exactly. I thought was really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So it all ties together for folks. It's the perfect band in many
ways.
Makes
my little brain happy.
I think that it ties so nicely with what you said about like the zooming in, zooming out, because for this it's like it's dropped and now it's a different character being portrayed.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I want to say like autobiographical, but certainly different from the voice that we heard throughout the other tracks. And it's almost like it's zooming out on like the Mountain Goat's discography and like zooming back in where it needs to, and it's saying like these are parts of like the old Mountain Goats, and like this is like, what's he say, like stay warm inside the ripple. Where it's like, this is the old sound that you're used to, and like we won't produce that as much anymore, because he's referencing like newer songs through the discography that have a different feel, like This Year and that kind of stuff. So it's like taking a look at like, oh, I'm hiding that old sound in the new music, and you just have to keep like thinking about the way that both types of the music that we produced coexist together, and the way that it takes both sides of like that kind of fan base that he has, where it's like the classic Mountain Goats and like the new Mountain Goats, and like mixes them together in a way where it's also like almost a religious blending.
I like stay warm inside the ripple of the Panasonic hum. I would not call that pandering, but it is very like so an understanding like of how much this music means to people.
Well, it's just like you have so many people telling you that like they didn't die because of what you did, like it must mean an incredible amount to him.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. And just like the fact that like that sound and like that machine like can mean so much, and like attributing that, like that again, this like very small, very insular group of people who have like a strange obsession with something that no one else really understands. It's no wonder why he relates so much to the pagans, you know, and to these cults.
Yeah, Dean, do you want to give us a quick send-off for this week's listening party? Thank you so much for listening, everybody.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you guys, my dear friends, for listening to this album with me.
Of course.
And being subjected to me talking about it for 2 hours.
I really enjoyed this. I keep learning quite a bit every time we do a deep dive. Even when I think I know something, I learn something new, which
has been helpful too, because I haven't been working on my thesis very much, and this made me feel like I was.
So thank you all for listening to this week's listening party.
Thank you for listening with us. You can follow us on Instagram @listeningpartycfrc, And we love when people send us messages on what they think of the albums we're listening to as well, because we're only 90% smart. Fill in the 10% people.
Exactly.
We do love fan participation.
I was going to say one last line from my boy JD. Like, we can make it through this year. We can do it. We only got like 5 more months.
If we have to crawl there on all fours.
We're all, just get a lot of rocks. Keep them in your pockets.
You never know
when you're going to
need to cast them at.
Beauty.